I got a haircut. The person who cuts my hair cuts both men's and women's hair. And she had, I realized, like, you know, there's like a desk or whatever in front of where you're sitting, and hanging underneath were hair extensions in multiple colors.
Yes,
like
yes,
a row
yes.
of them.
I think more
colors.
Men should do extensions.
It'd be great. You know, just show up one day with my
like
otherwise...
Like a full head of hair.
Exactly. Or my otherwise short hair and like a really long...
A rat tail.
Ponytail. Rat tail.
Yes.
Braided.
If the president has said this once, he's said it 1,000 times, over and over for years.
We're the piggy bank that everybody steals from, including China.
His tariffs pushed China to negotiate.
But how close are the two nations to a deal? I'm Steve Inskeep with Noel King, and this is Up First from NPR News.
And what does a Russian woman have to say from inside an American prison? Maria Butina is so far the only Russian arrested after Russia played a role in the 2016 election. Our colleague Mary Louise Kelly has the first U.S. interview since Butina admitted to conspiracy.
Also, Pope Francis orders Catholics to alert church leaders of sexual abuse or cover-ups.
He has said all the right things, but I don't think he has acted strongly enough.
How strong are the new rules? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Panera Bread. At Panera, breakfast to go no longer means to settle. Try their new maple glazed bacon, scrambled egg and cheese breakfast wrap, and new Madagascar vanilla cold brew. Panera, food as it should be. Support also comes from WeTransfer, more than a file sharing service, with products to capture, collect, present, and share ideas from anywhere on any device. For bringing ideas to life and getting you back to yours. More at leave.bywetransfer.com.
If you're an American and you order goods from China, the tax bill that is part of the price you pay may have gone up overnight.
That's right. As promised, the U.S. put higher taxes on a range of products made in China. Now, Americans will pay the tax, but this move is meant to pressure China. President Trump's administration did this just as negotiators met for trade talks. So what are the prospects here for success?
Who better to ask than NPR economics correspondent Scott Horsley, who's on the line. Scott, good morning.
There's got to be somebody better to ask.
Well, I don't know. You're the one who's available, Scott. So are the two sides giving any hints of progress?
Not really, except that the Chinese delegation did in fact show up here in Washington. They talked last night, the talks continued over dinner, and they're going to be back at it this morning. So I guess you could say that is a sign, at least, that things have not broken off entirely.
Because of the new tariffs, that didn't cause things to fall apart. But let's note the way that the president has been talking about these tariffs. We have some tape here. Let's listen.
So our country can take in $120 billion a year in tariffs, paid for mostly by China, by the way. Not by us. A lot of people try and steer it in a different direction. It's really paid, ultimately, it's paid for by largely by China.
Is that accurate that the tariffs are largely paid by China?
No, it's not. Despite what the president says, economists believe the bulk of these tariffs are paid by businesses and consumers here in the U.S. In cases where there's easy substitutions, China might absorb some of the cost to stay competitive. But generally speaking, tariffs are paid by people on this side of the Pacific. The other big cost, Steve, is felt by our exporters because China, like other trading partners, has responded to the president's tariffs by imposing tariffs of its own, and that makes it harder for Americans to sell their products in China.
I want to keep that reality in mind for a moment, Scott, because you've told us that Americans are largely paying these tariffs. And that does raise a question. Why would China care if the United States is raising tariffs? Because it does seem that they care.
Right. Well, the president says that these tariffs will force American customers to go back to buying from American suppliers. And there may be some cases where that happens. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who say what they do is they just look for a cheaper supplier in some other country, like Vietnam.
Oh, so maybe that would be China's ultimate fear here, is that there is increasing friction between China and the United States, increasing costs in doing business in China for Americans, and Americans would just end up looking somewhere else in the world.
That's right, a threat that they could over time lose market share, but that's not something that's going to happen right away. We should say, Steve, there is a little bit of wiggle room here because the higher tariffs that took effect at midnight don't apply to goods that were already in transit as of, you know, 11:59 on Thursday. And it does take time for goods to cross the ocean. So that means there's still a little bit of a window here when a deal could still be struck before these higher tariffs really start to be felt in the United States.
And I suppose there's a little time before another shoe drops because China has said they will respond to these tariffs, but we don't know yet exactly how or when.
That's right. And, you know, the president is also threatening to expand tariffs onto a whole lot of other Chinese goods. China has limited options to respond to that because we simply buy a lot more from them than they buy from us.
Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Next, we have the voice of a Russian woman inside an American jail.
My name is Maria Butina, and I'm a Russian citizen, and now I guess I'm an inmate.
Maria Butina is so far the only Russian arrested after Russia played a role in our 2016 election. She pled guilty to conspiracy to act as an agent of Russia.
And she's given her first U.S. media interview since she was sentenced to Mary Louise Kelly of NPR's All Things Considered, who's here. Good morning.
Good morning.
How do you talk to somebody in jail?
You ask her to call you.
Okay, and that's what you did?
It's exactly what I did. I had been out to meet her at prison in Alexandria weeks ago and talked to her at some length, but you're not allowed to bring recorders in there or your phone or even a spiral notebook. So after she was sentenced, I wondered whether she might be more free to speak. And we went back and forth with her lawyer and asked her to call. And at a appointed hour yesterday, the phone in the studio rang up with a collect call and we answered and we talked.
Well, let's remember, this is an individual who was very colorful, who was active on the social scene in the United States.
The long red hair. We've all seen the pictures.
Sure,
and,
Yeah. So what did she say about what her role was? What was she doing here?
My central question was, who are you? What is your story? Why did you come to America? So we talked about her interest in gun rights, her Republican Party connections, how she built those into an unofficial influence campaign here in the U.S., which she says was not in any way part of any broader Kremlin effort to subvert U.S. democracy or swing the 2016 election. She says she was here to promote peace. And I said, but come on, you were here in 2016 and 2017 and 2018 when the Russia story was front page every day. What were you thinking about how you fit into that? And here's part of what she told me.
It has been very painful for me because my idea, I came here as a peace builder. I've never hide my love to my motherland, neither to this country. I love both countries. This is the worst pain of my situation now, was that I am embarrassed that instead of creating peace by not registering, I created discord. That is what I'm going to carry for the whole my life.
The not registering, she's talking about the requirement if you are a foreigner here and working for a foreign government to register as a foreign agent, and which she did not do.
But I believe she admitted to passing information on to well-connected, Kremlin-connected Russians. So does she admit she was a spy?
She does not. I asked her that point blank. She said, no, I am not a Russian spy. We did have a long back and forth about any relationship which she had with Russian intelligence services. She says she never worked for them. She does acknowledge her relationship with a Russian official named Alexander Torshin, the guy who was identified as her handler. He, very close to the Kremlin, former Russian senator and central banker, who's sanctioned by the U.S., by the way. And I asked, did you know he was passing on the information you were feeding him, that he was feeding it to Russia's foreign ministry? Here is part of her answer.
Yes, I did meet certain people. Not all of them, but some of them are known to Mr. Torshin. We know he did some reporting or some notes to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. We don't know if they ever went to any intelligence services. And it feels for me that this is like all a potentially, possibly speculation, which has no evidence, so I do question the U.S. justice system, and I think you guys should too.
Although she did plead guilty to a crime, is it clear what, if anything, Russia might have learned through Maria Butina?
No. We know that she reported back on her contacts, that she reported back on the relationships that she was building. We know that she is questioning her sentence. She thinks 18 months is a ridiculous sentence to have been given for what she says she did. We know she's joined in questioning that by Vladimir Putin, who's called her sentence an outrage. But she, despite all this, she says, I love America. You guys, you Americans in general, you're wonderful.
Mary Louise, thanks so much. We'll listen for more of that interview on NPR programs.
Thanks, Steve.
That's NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. Some other news now. Pope Francis has issued new rules ordering priests and nuns around the world to report incidents of sexual abuse or cover-ups to church authorities.
Yeah, before this order, clergy members in some countries didn't have to report sexual abuse to anyone at all. The new orders change that, but they don't require the incidents to be reported to prosecutors, except in places where local laws already mandate. Mari Collins was abused by a priest when she was a child, and she says the new guidelines are a step in the right direction, but she thinks there's still a long way to go.
In this day and age, that they need to put all this down now and say you have to report is mind-boggling. I think someone's conscience alone, particularly someone in the church, should have been thinking this way anyway without having to have a law telling them they have to do it.
NPR's Tom Gelton covers religion for NPR News, and he's here. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Steve.
I'm just thinking this through. In the United States, if I'm not mistaken, teachers, principals in schools and so forth, they have to report things to the authorities. It sounds like there may still be cases even now where church priests and nuns may not have to report to civil authorities. Is this enough of a change?
Well, Steve, it is a big change in the sense that what you're talking about is what happens in this country. And the big loophole, the big problem with this is that in the developing world, in many countries around the world, they don't have these procedures, these mandatory reporting laws that we have in the United States. The Catholic Church in the United States has already done a lot, but in many places around the world, nothing has happened. And that's what's important here, is that the Pope has mandated that Catholics everywhere across the world have to have a system in place to report allegations of sex abuse. That's new.
Meaning, regardless of the country, there must be someone designated, some bishop, some whatever, someone you would go to and say, there's a problem, I know evidence of a problem.
Very detailed procedures in this new law of exactly how it should happen, to whom it should be reported, how it should be reported, etc.
Although, I'm sure that there are people listening now who are familiar with stories that have come out over the past couple of decades where church officials did know of abuse and did nothing. Are there any consequences if people do not act as they're required under this law?
This law sets out procedures. It does not set out punishments. And that is a problem, I think, from the point of view of church critics. The church has not, the Vatican, the Pope has not laid out what enforcement provisions are going to be in here. I mean, he says what you have to do, but he does not say what happens if you don't do what you're supposed to do. And that is a problem. Presumably, the Vatican will come out with more information, more procedures as far as enforcement is concerned. We haven't seen that yet.
Well, we heard the one criticism of Pope Francis, but let me understand the depth of that criticism. When you hear from advocates on this issue, are they saying, I disagree with some details, but like what Pope Francis is doing? Or are they saying, I'm beginning to doubt Pope Francis's sincerity on this issue?
This is a big enough move that critics of the church, advocates for survivors, are saying it's significant, it's not trivial. They're not satisfied with it. You mentioned at the beginning that there's no mandatory reporting to civil authorities except where that's applied under the law. But, you know, in general, I think that survivors and their supporters say this is an important step.
Tom, thanks for your insights. Always appreciate it.
You bet.
That's NPR's Tom Gelton. And that's up first for this Friday, May 10th. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. Our producer is Bo Hamby. Our editors are Eric McDaniel and Steve Mullis. Our music is composed by Nick Dupre and Louis Weeks. Kenya Young is the executive producer of Up First. We hope you start your day here with us on Monday, and you can subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps the show if you rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Up First is here each day because of your NPR station. Your financial support keeps them going. They keep us going. That's the way it works. Support your station now, and if you want to find out how to reach them, go to donate.npr.org. Also, start your weekend with NPR's Weekend Edition, which you'll find on your station.
What would you do if you found out a story that had shaped your identity was a lie? NPR's new podcast, White Lies, investigates a murder in Selma, Alabama from 1965.
And exposes the conspiracy that kept it unsolved. Until now. White Lies. Start listening Tuesday.